A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. You can catch me every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital in London, online at shareradio.co.uk. And if you have a smartphone or a tablet, through the Share Radio mobile app. In the studio with me today for our weekly catch-up is editor Simon Lambert-Bagg, joined by personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, how do you solve a problem like tax credits?
To pull ourselves out of debt, we should not be forcing those working families into it.
Well, the team will explain what the Chancellor's plans for slashing the welfare bill mean for low-income households. Also, after an 18-month inquiry, we're being told the current account market isn't competitive enough. But rather than recommend a breaking up of the big four banks, it's us, the consumer, being told to switch.
The danger is that the banks become complacent. They use their current account holders as a source of profit and don't give them adequate reward for their business.
We also have a host of seasonal property stories as we say goodbye to British summertime as the evenings get darker and temperatures plummet. Up go our energy bills, but so too burglaries. The team will tell us what you can do to save on energy and protect your belongings. Also, with government cuts to subsidies for solar panels, does it make sense to buy, even though they may have saved people hundreds of pounds already? We also take a look at the situation for first-time buyers as they go head-to-head with buy-to-let landlords.
There's a lot of competition for the sort of property that first-time buyers like to buy.
What's the solution? Well, being urged to win hearts and minds of sellers as the average asking price for first-time homes goes up almost 10% in a year. We'll tell you how. What is equity release? Could it be the right choice for you? And also on the agenda with Simon and Rachel today, now we all have memories of our old cars. Perhaps you had your first road trip in it, had its own name, Furry Dice, or you stole a little kiss in it, or perhaps more. Have you ever wondered what happened to it, though, after you sold it all those years ago? Well, now is your chance to find out after the government launched a new vehicle MOT history website. It's not really what it's for, car stalking. It's to give us a chance to check our vehicles on the second-hand market before we buy. But it will also become a tool for automotive nostalgia. Ah, the memories. So I've been asking today, I want to know your first car, the memories. Do you have any idea where it is now? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Simon, are you one for automotive nostalgia?
Yeah, definitely. My first car was a Peugeot 205, mm-hmm. and I loved it. It was a great car. It was a wonderful little car. And I actually knew where it was for quite a long time because I'm the eldest of four kids. Oh. So I had it, and then my sister had it when I had a different car. And then I had it back for a period of time, and then my brother had it. And then finally it left our happy little family. And I looked it up on the website, and I think the last MOT on it was 2006. So sadly, it looks like it's off the road. I'm hoping that it's sat sawn somewhere, ready to be loved by a future classic car enthusiast and bring
Disney
it back to life.
Disney movie waiting to happen, isn't it? Rachel, yourself, are you sentimental about your first car?
Maybe I will be one day. I've never owned one.
You've never owned a car?
No. But what a genius little tool. I know it's there for good and proper purposes, but car stalking, I just don't know who wouldn't want to do that.
Who wouldn't exactly want to, except me?
So you've been able to look up this information before, but it's not delivered quite as much information. And the key difference with this thing is you no longer need the reference number from the V5 registration document. You just need the number plate and the make.
Do you
and
still
that's
remember
what enables
the
you
number
to do
off
it.
By heart?
J676KHG.
Wow.
But I can't remember the number plate of my next car after that. So I'm desperately trying to remember that.
Yeah, I don't want to look up. The reason why I had first car, VW Golf, it was a shared one between myself and my brother. I went away on holiday. It got sold. My mum sold it.
Oh.
Yeah. And then bought a car for my brother's fiancé. So my VW, I don't care where it is.
Can I just point out, Georgie, that your mum did buy it?
That's not the best for me. Honestly, I know this. I know I should let this go. I know this was about 20 years ago.
Evil guy producer always comes in.
I know this was a while ago, and I'm getting therapy over it. But honestly, she bought it for me.
I know.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio on digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the top stories that they've been looking at over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Now, lots to get through today. Riddle me this. We talk tax credits. And as the clocks go back, winter sets in. You have more to worry about than your heating bills. But first, after an 18-month investigation into our £16 billion current account and business banking sector, the results are in. Drumroll, please. Banks are apparently not working hard enough to compete for our custom. Our reporter Tim Jones has more.
Big banks have been able to take their existing customers for granted, according to the competition watchdog. Its chairman, Alastair Smith, says people need to switch more.
That's the key to putting banks under pressure and making banks work harder for us.
Alex Neal is from consumer group Which.
The solutions they're proposing seem to put it all back in the consumer's court.
Cyrus Ardalan left Barclays for a small startup. He says there are options out there.
The reason why our bank was created was to try and address that shortfall in the market.
The CMA claims switching could save the average person £70 a year.
So £70 a year, not to be sniffed at, and for the heavy overdraft users, that could go up to £260, and yet just 3% of us moved account last year. That's despite the introduction of the new seven-day switching rules brought in a couple of years back. To put that in context, only 8% of us moved in the last 3 years, compared with 45% who changed car insurance provider. Well, Kevin Pratt says if people don't switch, it could harm us further in the long run.
The danger is that the banks become complacent. They use their current account holders as a source of profit and don't give them adequate reward for their business. So that's why the CMA is interested in this. It's published this interim report. It's not gone down terribly well. So I expect by the time the full report comes out next year in May, we may see some more radical proposals. But they've taken a few steps down the road towards injecting some life into the current account market.
Kevin Pratt from Money Supermarket there. OK, so we don't switch enough, but we knew that. 57% of us have stayed with our banks for more than 10 years, 37% for 20. What the report said was that the current market is not working, but they stopped short of recommending a breakup of the top four. Now, Simon, the headlines all seem to be taken with the £70 figure that we could save if we moved. But as we'll get onto a little bit later in the show, and let's be honest, £70 is not to be sniffed at, and I'm not suggesting it is. You could save more than that potentially by switching your light bulbs. So what did you make of the report? What was the significance for you? Some say it was perhaps more relevant for what it didn't say than what it did.
I would suggest that the CMA probably shouldn't have gone with the £70 thing. If I was in charge of that report, that I didn't think that that was particularly hard-hitting. You could save £70, not a month, not a week, not a day, but a year. So basically, less than a tenner a month. And I think that most people will have looked at that, who are the kind of people who they're trying to get to switch current accounts, you know, not people for whom that sum of money, you know, is a really, really big sum, a life-changingly different sum of money. And they will have gone, yeah, I can't be bothered.
Yeah.
I still can't be bothered.
For the hassle and the risk and the fear of switching.
And I find it really difficult to understand why more people don't switch their bank accounts, because banks will pay you to do it. And I think it's a little bit unfair, the criticism that the banks come in for sometimes on this, because they will literally give you free money to move your bank account. If they don't give you free money, many of them will pay you interest that is way over the odds of what you could get on a savings account. And yes, terms and conditions always apply. There are restrictions as to who can get some of these accounts. With some of them, you have to pay in a certain amount every month. But a lot of people qualify for these accounts. In fact, I would probably suggest that a lot more people qualify for the really good bank accounts than would qualify for a balance transfer credit card, for example, where they only have to give the balance transfer or the rate to 51% of successful applicants. Yet people still aren't switching their bank accounts. I've switched my bank accounts twice probably in the last 15 years. I've never regretted any of it, you know. And even, to give the current example, First Direct will pay you, I think, it's either 150 at the moment or 125. And that is the bank that comes out top for customer service almost across the board. So if basically the best bank out there will give you 125 quid and you still won't move your bank account, I'm not sure what more can be done.
Let's talk about the report more generally. You've come under some criticism, Rachel, from consumer groups for not going far enough, but also for placing too much emphasis on us, the consumer.
It's true. I mean, it said basically that the market isn't working in the best interests of consumers, that banks aren't working hard enough for our custom. So its response to that, well, consumers have to work harder to make their banks work better. Mm. It's all on the consumers to shop round, make sure you're getting the best deal. And what do the banks have to do? Well, they have to, if they make a mistake, at that point they should send you some kind of letter saying, don't forget, you can always switch to a rival.
Rachel, what do they have to do? Because there are a number of proposals in this. That was one of them.
That's one. They have to do more. There's a lot about small businesses and the raw deal that they're getting around current accounts. So more to help them switch with a comparison website as well for them. But what it did not say, which many people thought it would, is that banks should tell us what we're paying for our current accounts. Mm. At the moment, we have no idea. I mean, I suppose you can sort of tell from the £70 that you could save by switching, the sort of level. But also, £70 isn't a huge amount over a month, over a year, potentially. But £260 if you go into your overdraft, you know, over time that adds up. And then, as Simon says, if it's also costing you the £125 that you don't get for signing up for a better one, then it all sort of starts to stack up, doesn't it?
Well, it does indeed. Tell us a little bit more about the new changes to switching that came in this 7-day service. It's even easier than it ever has been, surely.
Yeah, they'll switch you within 7 days. So basically you go through the official switching process and they will switch your bank account within 7 days.
And you don't have to worry about anything. You just give your details to the new bank.
You don't have to worry about anything. You do have to worry about it, because only a lunatic would basically go, oh, I just presume it'll all be fine. You do need to check up on these kind of things. I wouldn't advocate anybody just like hopes that they've got a new bank account that they get their wages paid into next month. But it really is, it is very easy if you go through these switching services. Mm-hmm. Although actually, I think that what's happening as well is I've recently had to open an extra account in joint names with my mum, basically to get some money paid into. Mm. And I think that if you don't go through the switching process, it's now got harder to open a bank account because it's taken forever. And my mum's also been trying to add my name to a couple of her business accounts, and that's taken forever as well. So there's a part of me that wonders whether the banks are so snowed under this whole 7-day switching thing that once you fall outside of that, you might have an issue. But one of the suggestions actually that's being made as to one way to get people to switch is account number portability. The argument is, if you could take your bank account number with you, more people would be likely to switch. I'm never so sure that I entirely buy into that, because, you know, they say, well, once you can take your mobile phone number with you, and that makes people more likely to switch mobile phones. But your mobile phone number is how someone contacts you. That's the number you give out to people. You say, yeah, this is my number, call me on that number. Mm-hmm. Whereas your bank account number, I mean, yes, you get paid money on it, but it's not really the same relationship that you have with your mobile phone number. So I don't know, it's very difficult. The one thing I would say to anyone looking at switching bank accounts or evaluating their bank accounts is you should sit down, you should evaluate your bank account, you should think about switching. And don't just look at the incentives, look at the penalties, look at the overdraft charges, because some of these new bank accounts that will give you rewards will also charge you £1 a day for being overdrawn. So if you're the kind of person who doesn't spend all their time overdrawn, but maybe goes into their overdraft for like 5 days a month or something, mm, just before payday, you can end up racking up, you know, a fiver a month every single month, and all of a sudden you're paying quite a lot more for being overdrawn than if you were just being charged an interest rate.
I have to confess, I still haven't switched. And I tell you what, the current account number, I know it's very lazy, but that would make a difference for me, as would if there is a way of seeing all of your different accounts from various different, you know, your savings, ISAs, whatever, in one place through online banking. That would make a real difference. I'm with one bank, but with them I've got a joint account, my own account, and a savings account. And I can just shuffle stuff between them, mm-hmm, and I can see it all in one go. And I remember my password and I remember my account number if I ever need to use it. It's easy and I'm lazy. But I do think that might be a nudge that might help me.
But actually, you make a really good point here. And I've been reading some of the comments on This Is Money and Share Radio as well, saying, I'm quite happy with my bank. I'm quite happy with where I am. I don't really want to switch. Is this the best thing that they can come up with, is that switching is the answer to a market that's not competitive enough?
Well, I would say a couple of things on that. Firstly, use the My Data thing, but also use the power of people. So we have got on This Is Money our 5 of the best current accounts. These are the 5 that we think stand out for some reason. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/current and see what a real person says about those accounts and how they evaluate them. And secondly, I'd say that, you know, if you are happy with your bank account, yeah, that's fine. But you might be able to get a better deal somewhere else. And so it is worth considering doing it. And also, I think we're worrying about a problem from the past here. We're worrying about these big banks that dominate the current account market. I don't think that in 5 or 10 years' time, the current account market and the banking sector will look anything like it does today and be dominated by those big companies.
Are you talking about regulation? What are you talking about?
Challenges and technology. Technology will change the game. Someone will come in and manage to change the game. And the service that Rachel was talking about, you know, where you can pull all of your accounts from different providers, that's what you mean, isn't it? People have tried that. There's some stuff in the States that does it. Actually, there was a business set up by our own business, by the Daily Mail Media Group, called On Trees, that pulls all that stuff in and has now actually been sold to Money Supermarket. And it does work, but the only problem is that you don't have that security of like one login and then you can actually move the money. So you can see all your stuff there, but if you want to move the money, you have to log in individually to your bank account, and that's due to this security element. And I think that's where technology will take over. Something will come in that will make it secure, that will mean that people will trust it, and you will be able to just log into one thing and then move your money around all those different accounts.
Do you think that was taken into consideration, all of these aspects, when they decided the CMA report not to split up the big four? I mean, Barclays, HSBC, Lloyds Banking, Royal Bank of Scotland, 85% of business current accounts, 90% of business loans are through these four big banks. Do you think they get factored in challenges that it wasn't necessary to suggest splitting them up?
I just think we've got more. I think we've got so many important things to worry about in this country that I think going out and trying to start splitting up the retail banking elements of these big banks and forcing customers to be sold to elsewhere, because that's what happened with some of the Lloyds stuff. They were forced to basically send customers elsewhere. And some of these customers were like, I don't want to go anywhere else. You know, I like it here. So I just think that for the gain that you would make from it, it would be too much effort. And I think that technology, innovation and challenges will deliver that on their own.
One final point before we move on. This is just an interim report, isn't it? The final report's going to be out in about May next year. Do we expect much to change, Rachel?
It doesn't sound like it, does it? I mean, they've seemed quite clear that it's about switching, and I think that they'll try that first. And there's talk about having a sort of big awareness campaign to so that people understand what they can do. I think they'll try out all of that first before they do anything more dramatic. So we end up with yet another report. I mean, we have them for energy, for insurance, now we have it for current accounts, that the answer is you have to shop around.
Well, now let's switch subjects, shall we? On to how do you solve a problem like tax credits? That is the question that you, Simon, have asked this week. The argument's heating up in Parliament over the government's plans to slash the payments from next April. The Institute for Fiscal Studies says it could leave 3 million of Britain's poorest families out of pocket by a huge £1,000 a year. Now, Labour was defeated in a vote this week in its attempt to force a rethink of the government's plans, but a number of Conservative MPs also spoke out.
To expect people to immediately find more hours or better paid work suggests, I'm afraid, a level of naivety about the skills of some of our people. To pull ourselves out of debt, we should not be forcing those working families into it.
Now, the government's arguing they need to be cut to reduce the current welfare bill, and the new national living wage and higher tax-free personal allowance will plug that gap. But Shadow Work and Pension Secretary Owen Smith, not convinced.
These aren't the people whom the Chancellor likes to call the scroungers. These are hard-working people on low-income jobs, and tax credits have been a vital lifeline for them, and the Conservatives know that as well as we do. Well, the Prime Minister said he wasn't going to do this before the last election. I think that was a lie, and I think Tories know that right across the House, and I think we've got to urge them to do the right thing and stop these cuts.
So, Simon, before we look at how we solve the problem, what on earth is the problem in the first place? What are tax credits?
Tax credits are essentially a way of topping up low wages. So what happens is everybody gets a certain amount and then there are elements added on top of it. And then once you earn above a certain amount, so with the working tax credit, for every extra £1 of pre-tax income earned above £6,420, claimants lose 41p of tax credit. So it basically tapers down. Those claiming child tax credit also experience tapering, but from the much higher threshold of £16,105. Now, what this row is about is that George Osborne wants to dramatically lower that point at which you start getting the taper, so from 6,420 to 3,850, and at the same time the taper will increase. So instead of losing 41p in the pound, you basically lose 48p in the pound. And the effect of this, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is the report that's being quoted by everyone, is that it's basically going to cost people £1,000 a year. The 3 million of the poorest families in the UK could lose £1,000 a year. Now, it's worth pointing out that I think Mr. Osborne disputes this and says that actually, because they're bringing in the new national living wage, also the stuff they've done in terms of raising the personal allowance, people aren't going to suffer as much, and actually they are helping the low paid. But the IFS has said, well, that's not the case. And in fact, I think I read something where basically the IFS said that what he was suggesting was mathematically impossible. And the call is for him to come out and basically answer this IFS report and say what's going to happen. So all eyes now are what's going to happen between now and when he does his autumn statement, and is he going to change his mind and row back on this?
Now, we'll be talking about the fact that the system has had a few problems since it was introduced, but the fours and against, I thought both the left, the right, everybody was reunited in their desire to stop this idea of subsidising low wages with tax credits, get big businesses to pull their fingers out and pay what they should do. Is it just a question, I guess, of speed?
Yeah, so this is my point. OK, now, I think that tax credits are a mess, and I think that they subsidise companies that pay low wages. I think we live in a low-wage economy, and I think that it is no coincidence that since tax credits, as in their current form, are introduced in 2003 and the bill for them has ballooned, that we have seen wages kept down. And what this means is that big companies, especially, manage to get away with paying people less money than they need to live on, because everybody else, including actually the people who are being paid those low wages, are picking up the tab for topping up the wages. And that means that those big companies can make bigger profits, and that means that those big companies can pay out bigger dividends to their shareholders. And I don't think that that's right. And there's a lot of people who don't think that that's right. And I think that this is what Osborne is getting at with some of this stuff. Mm. It's not that he's just some, like, lunatic with an ideological crusade against poor people, because I don't think that he is. He wouldn't have raised the personal allowance if that was the case. But I don't think he's going about it the right way. I think that it has to be accepted that this is being done too quickly. And also, as you say, there is agreement on the left about this. A lot of people on the left don't agree with this subsidising of low wages. So I think what we need to do is think a lot more long term. This is like typical of our short term thinking, and it's also typical of this political round. This subject, dealing with the tax credits mess, is too important for politicians to be standing there throwing arguments at each other across the Houses of Parliament. They should get some form of cross-party agreement to look at this and work out how we're going to solve this problem and then do something about it. And probably the first bit of it is for Mr. Osborne to not try and cut them so harshly, because, as I said in my column, that £100 a month that people are going to lose, for the people who've done well out of the recovery, that's an expensive bill at Waitrose. Mm-hmm. For the people struggling on low wages, that's the difference between keeping their head above water and not.
The timing as well for the Conservatives is, let's be honest, far from ideal. People are likely to receive notification, I believe, how much they're going to lose around about Christmas time. And we know what that does, don't we, in terms of headlines. Do you expect, and I'm not suggesting that's the only reason George Osborne might row back on some of these changes, but do you think there is a chance, a likelihood, that they might reconsider some aspects to these plans?
I think he's got to reconsider it in some way, because it's dividing his own party now. You've got Tories coming out and criticising it and saying that they need to change their mind. And what I referred to this, there was this brilliant article written by Frank Field, the Labour MP, in the Evening Standard. In it, he talked about tax credits and said that this system needs reform. He said it does not make sense to take tax from low earners and then give them back this money in the form of tax credits. But then he also said tax credits are a crucial source of income for those people who get out of bed in the morning and travel to a job that pays them poverty wages. Many of these workers, who most of us think of as the nation's drivers, voted for the Tories at the last election because they believed they could trust them to protect their standard of living. That's what it comes down to, is that's not what's going to happen. So, I mean, yeah, if he goes back on it, then there'll probably be some political point scoring. But really, does he need to worry about that? They've just been elected. They've got another 5 years in charge. It's a long way till the next general election.
Editor Simon Lambert also joined in the studio with personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
So you want to learn to make the most of your money. Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches. Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up
and down. Let's talk. Huge debt.
Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the test and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, every Monday at 9 p.m. And if you miss an episode, go to the Share Radio website to find out when it's repeated, or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your no-zone layer.
Now, before we move on, I do want to know, Simon, on your website talking about tax credits, you have posed a question to readers. Should George Osborne slow his tax credit cuts? Where are we at?
Well, 45% of people think he should slow the cuts, and 55% of them think he shouldn't. So our readers do say that he shouldn't. But look, our readers, most of them aren't getting tax credits. Most of our readers tend to be wealthier, earn more money. But I think that this is one of those things where you have to recognise it's not about the tax credit system itself. It's about taking £100 a month out of the pocket of people who can't afford to have £100 a month taken off them right now.
Rachel, can I get your views on this?
I completely agree. I think the sort of ideology makes a lot of sense that, yes, people should be paid higher wages so that they're not dependent on tax credits. And yes, it's wonderful that the personal allowance is going up as well. But if in practice it's not the case that people end up making up this shortfall in the short term or medium term, it's just not fair. £1,000 a year, if you're on the lowest wages, I just don't know how you'd manage that. And Frank Field also pointed out that this was announced in the same budget that the inheritance tax allowance went up. It sits uncomfortably with their message of, supporting hardworking people.
Well, so far we've looked at our stickability when it comes to our banks. And I don't know, did we actually figure out how to solve a problem like tax credits? We certainly took a look at the arguments. But now let's focus on our homes and the time of the year, for 'tis the season for burglaries, apparently. As the clocks go back, evenings get darker, the number of home insurance claims rockets. That's according to a two-year study from Cooperative Insurance. They reckon there's an almost 40% increase in the 5 months after the end of British summertime compared with the previous 5 months. And it's not just our homes at risk. Watch out for your cars as well. Now, Rachel, it might seem like a bit of an obvious question, but what are the reasons for it? It's not like we're getting slacker about security or anything, is it?
No, it's just dark for so long, isn't it? I mean, you don't even have to get up in the middle of the night if you want to rob someone's house in the winter. It's dark by 4 o'clock. So I don't think it's about necessarily people doing anything differently. It's just opportunists. It's so much easier, isn't it?
Well, what I think this reflects, there's something here that says thefts in the winter months were also found to be more likely on a Friday than any other day of the week. Perhaps as it's more probable that occupants are out of the house. So basically, I think what this is most people think about getting burgled at night time, don't they? But actually, what this is suggesting is that burglars aren't striking at night time. They're striking in the evening when it's dark and when people aren't in, before you get home from work. Because obviously, if you break into someone's house in the night time, chances are they're in bed asleep. They might wake up, and a lot of burglary is opportunistic. And so you don't want them to wake up. Whereas if you do it, in the evening when you know they're out of work, you go round to their house, you ring the doorbell, they don't answer the doorbell, you ring the doorbell again, they don't answer the doorbell, and then you try and go in through the front door. And this actually happened to the front of our building last year, and I'm pretty sure it was during an evening time, not, night time when people were asleep. And someone had tried to force the front door of the building. We live in a converted Victorian terrace. And I reckon what they'd done is they'd come round, rung all the doorbells, found out no one was in, and then just tried to open it. And because when you're standing at a door now, you get so much stuff delivered, couriers, people handing out flyers, leaflets, things like that. You can get away with standing at someone's door and trying to jemmy it and nobody's going to see you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In this report, home robberies between November and March also more likely to happen due to burglars physically breaking into properties. Thefts which do not involve forced entry, such as those which are opportunistic or involve deception, are more likely to take place in the summer months. Car insurance claims as well also jump 6% after the clocks go back. Are some areas more at risk than others, did we find out as well?
East London is the most likely place in Britain to get burgled, is East London. The RM8 postcode of Dagenham and Beckentry, which has an average house value of £220,000, has the highest rate of burglary insurance claims. 14 of the top 20 postcodes are in London. Also, you are quite likely to be burgled DD2, DG1, G83, IP11 and LL57 postcodes. I'm not sure where those places are off the top of my head, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, I'm sure the people listening will know and recognise, and bad luck. I mean, obviously a lot of this is a bit of bad luck as well, but are there things you can do to try and limit your risk? Things like leaving the lights on. We'll be talking about leaving the lights on in a minute. But yeah, things like that.
I think what you should do is leave a child alone in the house and they can set up a TV programme and maybe some traps that can swing down from the ceiling.
Only at Christmas time, though,
only
right?
Only at Christmas time, and ideally looks like a little angel like Macaulay Culkin.
Rachel, anything else? CCTV, apparently, and you don't actually have to have real ones. So the recommendations go here from the Cooperative Insurance who drew this up.
Deterrent, apparently also very effective. This idea of a light timer, that seems genius to me, because the problem with it gets dark so early is that you can tell when someone's in or not very easily.
You're talking about setting automatic timers on things.
If the lights are on, they're in. If the lights are off, they're definitely not. Very easy. Clear cut, unlike in the summer. So a light timer, so lights go on and off. It's not very energy efficient, but maybe it's worth it.
Well, we'll talk about energy efficiency in a short while, Simon.
Going back to Home Alone, there is a wonderful scene in Home Alone where the burglars are sat there on this road and everybody's gone away for Christmas and they say, watch this, and they time it as the lights come on in every single house because they've watched it the night before and they come on at the same time every night, obviously, because of the timer.
Who'd have thought? An educational programme as well as a Christmas entertainer. Fantastic. Well, talking about leaving the lights on, we'll be sticking with the darker, colder night, shall we? Temperatures plummet. Our energy bills go the other way as we reach to turn on the lights and crank up the radiators. So, Rachel, you've been looking at what you should and shouldn't do to save energy. What is good advice and what is false economy? So, firstly, how much do our bills tend to go up on average during the winter months? Is it quite substantial?
It depends on the type of central heating that you have. But yes, I mean, mine certainly sort of goes up by about 5 times, I think, as soon as you turn the heating on. And then the gas bill starts to kick in, that makes all the difference.
So we'll tackle this a little bit step by step, shall we? Starting with lighting, as we say goodbye to British summertime. Turn the clocks back. So first of all, what are some tips for saving cash on lighting? Now, you've got an article here. Can switching your light bulbs really save you £100 a year? Well, can it?
In theory, yes. If you have the least efficient light bulbs and you change them to the most efficient, yes, it can do. People used to be put off by the price of the new ones. They've got a lot cheaper as well, and they last a lot longer. So the savings can be considerable, especially if you have lots of those little spotlights. Mm. A bundle of them, they tend to get hot very easily, very quickly, and that's where they lose energy and it's more expensive. Change them to the new more efficient ones. Yeah, you could get to £100.
Nice. What about simply turning the lights off when they're not in use? I mean, obviously we've just talked here about leaving them on when we leave the house to avoid burglaries, and there's a balance here. But if we are in the house and there are lights that we can turn off,
it can add up. All of these little things, you know, not leaving things on standby, turning off lights in rooms that you don't use. It just about, I mean, so turning off lights probably end up being about £15 a year, which you add that to, you know, turning your heating down by 1 degree if you can, switching your light bulbs. I mean, they don't really take that much faff, but yes, it can all add up.
Well, you were talking about leaving things on standby. Now, one thing that you should leave on standby, am I right, or whatever the equivalent is called, is your radiator.
So we looked into this one and we asked the Energy Saving Trust, should you turn off radiators in rooms that you don't use, or will they drain heat from the rest of the house? The answer is probably yes, they will drain a little bit of heat from the rest of the house, but the savings are still higher if you turn off the radiators that you're not using, but not completely, because should there be a frost and they freeze, and that's not very good for your heating system. And also you've got the problem of damp. If you're saving a few quid for turning off the heating and then you've got yourself a damp issue, then what's the point? So apparently lots of radiators have a symbol, it looks like a snowflake, and that's the frost setting. So that's a good one for making sure that they're not completely off, so they'll keep things moving along nicely if the temperature drops below zero. And if not, just the lower setting. And even then, I mean, turn it up every now and again if it's a room that you're not using and you've got the door shut, which is what you're supposed to do to keep the heat into the rooms that you are using.
Well, let's stick with the topic of energy, Sean. We're going to turn our attention to solar panels. Now, this seems rather a popular subject on This Is Money. Now, a year ago, they'd seem pretty much the obvious solution for those who want to live a greener life and save a bit of cash. But your journalist, Tony Hazel, and solar panel enthusiast, I think we can say here, has written a rather extensive piece about them. A love letter, you could probably call it. So tell us a little bit more about Tony's article. Despite being a huge fan of solar panels, besotted, he says here, he's warning us to really think before we buy.
So what's happened with solar panels is that basically you get some payments from the government, a subsidy, in order to encourage people to have solar panels. And now this subsidy, called feed-in tariff, started out very high. I think it started out at above 40p kilowatt hour for the energy that you generate. And it's been cut and it's been cut and it's been cut. But up until now, what has managed to offset those cuts has been the fact that the cost of installing solar panels has plummeted. So if you had solar panels installed, I think going back 4 years ago when you were getting those big payments, then you would probably have ended up paying about £12,000 for a sort of average home system. If you do it now, you might be looking at maybe five or six. So you're getting much lower payments, but the return is still very good. And the return, I think, you know, for some people can work out like 7-8% a year. It's a really good return, possibly more. But the government wants to cut this, and it wants to cut this all the way down to the bone. It says the system is unsustainable. And that unless it cuts these payments all the way down to the bone, it's just going to have to end them altogether. And so as of the 31st of December, if you have panels installed, you will get the new set of payments, and that will bring the returns from solar panels down to almost nothing. And Tony, who has some solar panels and absolutely adores them.
Oh, he does.
Basically. Oh, he goes into great... This is a wonderful article. I would highly recommend reading this.
It's completely affected his relationship with Mrs. H as well.
Absolutely brilliant. He talks about how he's going around the house trying to turn this on when the sun's shining, turn that on when the sun's shining. Quickly, the sun's gone back in, turn the Hoover off, kind of thing.
It's when he talks about southeast facing and the rest of rooms.
Yeah, so he says basically they always say you want a south facing roof. People think southwest is best because to have your garden facing southwest is best because you get more of the light and you get it in the evening. But he says actually he thinks southeast is best because you use more energy in the morning. Now, it is true that people do this. I know a couple of people with solar panels, and in fact, my father-in-law has solar panels, and yeah, he's totally obsessed with this, the sort of the energy that they're getting from it and everything. But as Tony says, this is stopping, and he would not recommend anyone get these installed after the 31st of December for the returns, unless you were kind of someone who was really into the green energy.
Also, there's a poll on your website about this. Should we make such big cuts to solar panel payments? And as it currently stands, after around about 3,000 votes, it's pretty tied almost. It's yes, 48%, no, 52%. Now, we'll stick with our property homes theme. Spare a thought for first-time buyers, shall we? As if things aren't tough enough when you're buying your first home, new mortgage lending rules came in last year, and now we're hearing the battle with buy-to-let landlords has pushed asking prices for homes with two bedrooms or less up almost 10% in the last year. That's higher than for any other buyer, according to the property website Rightmove. They say the average asking price for a first-time buyer has risen £1,300 a month over the last year. Earlier I spoke to Miles Shipside from Rightmove.
There's a lot of competition for the sort of property that first-time buyers like to buy. So as well as first-time buyers benefiting from competitive mortgage rates and having to put lower deposits down, that's good for demand for first-time buyer type properties. But buy-to-let landlords are fighting for the same properties as well because they're getting good returns. So you've got a vicious circle of two sectors fighting over one sector. There are things that that first-time buyers can do to try and win, but yes, a landlord is in a strong position because they often have cash.
Well, that was Miles Shipside there. The advice? Cozy up to the seller. Woo them. Rachel, you were in this position recently. Did you win the heart and mind of your seller?
I didn't even realise, actually, that that was a possibility. We've got another article on this subject with advice from Sarah Beeney, and she talks about dropping a note through the letterbox once you've put in an offer to say how keen you are on the property, instead of emphasising the lovely, warm, fluffy reasons why you might want it. You love the house so much. You want to be near whatever school it is because you've got this young family, whatever it is. I had no idea that you could interact with the seller, that you're kept so far apart. You're kept apart by the two estate agents, and the whole process seems so cumbersome as a result that you would have to feed something through to your estate agent. You'd sort of ask them to reiterate that you're a first-time buyer, that you have your finances in place, but you don't know whether they are and really going to say that with the same kind of feeling and conviction that you might had you done it yourself. But I just didn't realise that you could do that, that you could talk to the seller. And actually, after we'd bought it and they'd sold up, they came to pick up a sofa that they'd left behind. they're so nice.
Aww.
And once it's all done round up, they're going to come round for tea. And we love them. And I wish that we'd met them earlier on. I think it would have been a lot simpler.
Well, it might have been, but I suppose the theory they're suggesting here, winning the hearts and minds of the seller, is because we're quite emotionally attached to our homes. Is that right? And so we'd rather it go to a new, nice owner as opposed to perhaps a buy-to-let landlord who may not love it as we love it. Is that the theory?
This is the theory. To me, it feels a little bit like clutching at straws
to
see what sort of advantage a first-time buyer might have over a landlord who perhaps has the cash up front and all these other things. Mm-hmm. You can do it a lot more smoothly. And this is backed up by the majority of the comments after our article, which largely say it's cash, cold, hard cash. And I think there's a monetary, you're effectively putting a monetary value on the emotions attached to a house. It's that sort of calculation. I'm sure in some cases it might help. And certainly if it's you who does go that extra mile, puts the nice note through the letterbox versus someone who doesn't, then perhaps that wins you an advantage. And really, in this kind of market, do what you can.
As a home owner, Simon, would it work on you, a nice letter through the post?
So I've always said to people that they should basically always get in touch with each other. Buyers and sellers always get in touch with each other because it helps iron out all those problems. And we had it when we sold before, the people buying off us. We were kept very much apart by the estate agents and they wouldn't let us get in touch. And there was all kinds of questions. It was falling apart. The estate agents were suggesting that these people were being but unreasonable. When we met up with them, they were wonderful. They were lovely people. Basically sorted everything out completely. But I think a lot of our readers are saying, yeah, it's cold, hard cash. I think it does make a difference. I think maybe in a situation where you've got two people bidding for your property and one's offering you $5,000 more than the other, you're going to go with the one offering you $5,000 more. But a lot of the time, people don't have two people bidding for their property. People have an offer that's on the table and then they have to make a decision as to whether to accept it. And that offer might be a few thousand pounds under their asking price. And it's like, do we take the money? Do we hold out for more? Now, if you can convince that person that you're going to love and cherish their house and, you know, you're going to be a new family that moves into it and takes over what they've done and all that hearts and minds stuff they're talking about here, I actually think that can make a difference between someone going, oh, yeah, let's sell it to them. They seem really nice. And going, no, we're going to hold out for more.
Well, it might make a difference, but let's focus on what we mentioned a little bit earlier in terms of the environment that they're in at the moment, that homes with two bedrooms or less are up almost 10% in the last year. It's a bit gloomy and doomy, isn't it? Especially with new mortgage rules that have come in. Rachel, what's the picture like? Green shoots on the horizon, maybe?
We've been saying that for the past year. I mean, with this kind of level of growth, people have been saying for a long time it's utterly unsustainable. How can you have close to double-digit growth for another year? But it just keeps going on and on and on. And this is at the time, yes, wages are growing, but for first-time buyers, it's probably slightly less. And even so, I mean, 2% wage growth versus 10% for homes. Sooner have you just got to the point where you might be able to afford the deposit and then it's out of your reach again. I don't know, it's impossible.
And homes obviously cost a lot more than people's wages are. So, you know, 10% on a home is 10% of a large number and 2% of your wages is 2% of a smaller number. So the gap just keeps getting bigger.
I can tell you that the property website Zoopla just did a poll and 9 out of 10 homeowners expect house prices to continue to rise in their area next year. It says on average people are hoping to achieve 7.2% over the next 6 months. It also claims 2 out of 10 people are considering putting their property up for sale. Well, if you don't want to put your property up for sale, but if you're low on readies, as Rachel asked, but you own an asset worth hundreds of thousands of pounds that you don't want to sell, what do you do? Now, this is the dilemma faced by thousands who, thanks to huge rises in house prices in recent years, find themselves with plenty of wealth tied up in their homes, but with little cash to perhaps pay for repairs, holidays, even essential bills. So for these people, equity release sounds, in theory, the perfect solution. So, Rachel, is it?
I looked into it because I thought, surely it has to be. It's such an obvious answer. Massive asset, no readies. What are you going to do if you can tap the value? Equity really seems to be one of the simplest ways of doing it, apart from, you know, if you've got extra rooms or something like that, renting out to a lodger. But it is expensive. And we've had a lot of stories recently about people being surprised at just how quickly the equity in their home is guzzled by these loans. The main reason is this magic of compound interest, which if you're a saver is your best friend, and if you have an equity release mortgage is a disaster, because that your debt just mushrooms over time. It can double in about 10 years if you're not careful. The other thing I looked at is, why are mortgage rates so high on equity release? They're about 5 to 6%, but they're against a guaranteed return. There's no sort of risk associated with these loans on the part of the lender. So I looked into why they are so high. And one reason is precisely that. There's no income until you die. Mm. And they don't know when that's going to happen. And so there's that sort of risk involved. Also, they have to ensure that the value of your debt is never going to exceed the value of your home, so that if you die, you don't end up with this extra debt. And that they take out some kind of insurance against, or they provide their own insurance, and that cost is passed on to you as the homeowner as well, which can add around another percentage point.
Personal finance editor Rachel Rickarn-Strauss, also in the studio, editor Simon Lambert.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Now let's finally talk about cars, our love of cars, particularly our old cars. As we've been hearing from listeners today, they do seem to hold a rather special place in our hearts. Perhaps you used to drive around with your first love, you took your first road trip in one, you got stranded in the middle of nowhere and have a lovely anecdote to tell, or you use it as a guilt trip for your mum every Christmas after she sold it on. Oh, the memories. Have you ever thought, though, who is driving your old car now? Is the rocking Elvis still in the back, the fairy dice? Who knows? Well, this could be your chance to find out, thanks to the government launching a new MOT history website. It's not for car stalking, it's to give us a chance to check out the vehicle's history before we buy it, but it's also a tool for automotive nostalgia. So Simon, tell us a little bit more. I believe you've got a little story to tell us about this.
I do indeed. So you've been able to check up on MOT history for some time, but you needed the reference number off the V5 registration document. And I doubt many people have memorised the reference number off their V5 registration document, so it's a bit tricky. You need to track that down. But now you can do it with just your number plate and the make of the car. And this leads to all kinds of checking up on old cars that you used to own, because it will tell you the MOT history, and the MOT history will reveal whether that car is still on the road or at what point it stopped having an MOT and probably went off the road. So I looked up a couple of my old cars, but I looked up one car that I had that was written off. Someone, a drunk driver, smashed into it when it was parked outside our house on the road one night and basically wrote it off. And the insurance company said, no, sorry, you know, it's not worth repairing. So they gave us some money, which, being an insurance company, was considerably less than the car was worth. And we had to take the money and moved on. But what happens with written off cars sometimes is, if they can be fixed, they do get sold on and then people can fix them up. They then have to be marked down as a, I think it's a Category D car when they're sold. They have to officially be marked down as that. But I looked up the silver Fiat Punto X231 NEB, and it is still on the road. Last MOT pass date, 22nd of May, 2014. So actually, maybe that's not the last one. So it should have had another one in 2015, shouldn't it? So maybe it's not still on the road. Damn. But the person who's driving it, it shows the mileage. It's only doing about 1,000 miles a year.
Probably can't do much more than that, to be honest.
But I'll tell you a funny story about when they wrote this car off. Basically, I had contact from my insurer about a year later, who said, oh, sorry for your complaint, we're dealing with the problem and we'll get back to you on it. And I was like, what complaint? I don't have a complaint. And then I ignored it, got another email, and it said, yes, sorry, we are dealing with this, we think we found the answer. So I called them up and I said, what's the problem? And basically they told me that when the car had been written off, someone with a fat finger had actually put the number plate in wrong. So they'd put in X321 NEB rather than X231 NEB, and the owner of X321 NEB, whatever car that was, only discovered it when they went to sell it, and the person they were selling it to said, no, sorry, your car's been written off. And they said, no, my car hasn't been written off. Turned out the insurance company had written off someone else's car.
Oh, my goodness me. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
Share Radio.